poisonous partisanship, closely divided and disputed elections, misgivings about the future democratic stability of the United States, America now, and America in 1887. In the quarter century before 1887, the United States had been riven by the Civil War, risked partisan meddling in close elections in both 1880 and 1884, and the nation had also been tested by a presidential election crisis in 1876, when states sent competing slates of electors to Congress. So finally, Congress resolved to protect the integrity of presidential elections. In 1887, both chambers passed the Electoral Count Act. There was just one problem. The Electoral Count Act is a hot mess. The law faced withering criticism from the moment it was enacted. Very confused, almost unintelligible, an ultra and unwise concession of power to the states, wrote political scientist John Burgess in 1888. With memories of the Civil War still fresh, Burgess warned of the dangers of the Electoral Count Act's muddled language. Quote, "We want a new baptism of nationalism all around," he wrote. "Let us hope that it will not again be one of fire." This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That concern rattled around the halls of legal and political scholarship for a century and a half. All the way to October 2020, when Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig said on this show that the ambiguities of the Electoral Count Act could prove irresistible to manipulation.
When you recognize that in these irrationally partisan times, Congress, these legal standards evaporate and Congress just behaves in a completely partisan way, the structure that the Electoral Count Act has set up is a potential disaster.
The disaster came on January 6th, 2021. First, when Donald Trump claimed that the vice president had the power to stop the electoral count and overturn the election.
All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify, and we become president, and you are the happiest people.
Then Congress was attacked. The electoral count stopped. But the shock wasn't sufficient to deter Republican members of Congress from challenging electoral slates from several states when the count resumed. Here's Alabama Representative Mo Brooks making the spectacular and completely false claim that a million non-citizens had illegally voted in November.
As such, it is my constitutional duty to promote honest and accurate elections by rejecting Electoral College vote submissions from states whose electoral systems are so badly flawed as to render their vote submissions unreliable, untrustworthy, and unworthy of acceptance.
And since January 6th, federal grand jury subpoenas have revealed a pro-Trump fake electors scheme in numerous states. Phoenix TV station CBS 5 reported how the scheme worked in Arizona.
When Joe Biden won the state of Arizona, he won Arizona's 11 electoral votes. This certificate, signed by the state's Democratic electors on December 14, 2020, was sent to Washington, D.C. But on the same day, a group of Republican electors gathered and created their own certificate, cast their votes for Donald Trump, and sent this fake certificate to D.C. as well.
According to the New York Times, emails between Arizona Republicans and the Trump campaign stated that the goal was to, quote, send in fake electoral votes to Pence so that someone in Congress can make an objection when they start counting votes and start arguing that the fake votes should be counted, end quote. Now, these are just three examples of a simple fact. The language of the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which was supposed to preserve the count's integrity, instead provided the exact opposite, the means for the attempted overthrow of a presidential election. Which is why Congress is acting with both urgency and rare bipartisanship to reform the archaic law. And last week, a bipartisan Senate working group finally unveiled the Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut is one of the bill's co-sponsors. How does he think the Electoral Count Reform Act remedies the vulnerabilities exposed by January 6th?
So one of Trump's legal theories was that the existing Electoral Count Act allows state legislatures to declare that the election wasn't completed. And Trump suggested that claims of fraud would be enough to declare an election incomplete. That's not the drafter's intention back from the late 1800s. What they meant was if, you know, a natural disaster prevented an election from moving forward, then the state legislature could come up with a different process by which to hold that election again or have the will of the voters expressed through the choice of electors. We, again, make the original intent of the bill pretty clear that only in the case of a natural disaster, of an election actually being interrupted, does the state legislature have any authority to step in and decide what happens next. The state legislature can't just say, well, I heard that there was some fraud in precinct A or precinct B, so the state legislature is now going to step in and decide who the electors are. That absolutely cannot happen under our bill. Trump argued that it could happen under the previous law.
The bill has seven Republican co-sponsors. What do you think that indicates about their level of concern about that period of vulnerability between November and January?
There, you know, still are many senators who deeply worry about President Trump's continuing efforts to try to put himself in power, no matter whether he wins or loses the election. And so we've been able to work pretty well with a number of high-profile Republicans. The intention is to make it harder for President Trump and his allies to try to steal the election in 2024. And I think that we will have enough Republican support in the end in the Senate to get it passed. And my hope is that the House will take it up and get it done by the end of the year before the 2024 campaign season begins.
In my mind, it's not even just 2024, right? The intention should be to strengthen this process for every presidential election to come, because once we've seen how it can be disrupted, there's always the risk of it happening again without these modifications.
You know, I think many of us were hopeful that this bill would go beyond just a reform of the Electoral Count Act. I certainly think that there are other infirmities in federal election law that allow states to deny the right to vote. We put a lot of those changes on the table, but in the end, we agreed that changing the Electoral Count Act by itself was so important that we should move forward with that project and set aside some of the discussions on broader voting rights changes for another day.
When you put out on Twitter that the bill was being released, it was a bipartisan effort. Lots of folks tweeted back at you saying, well, this seems like small potatoes to them because it's not really going to get at any of these bigger problems that are really shaking the foundations of our democracy. So, like, why bother? And you had pretty strong responses to that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm just not somebody that believes you always let the perfect be the enemy of the good. This bill is good. And I want people to understand that, you know, this is not a problem in our rearview mirror. President Trump is learning from the mistakes he made in the lead up to January 6th, and he is constructing a coalition that will be able to successfully steal the election in 2024. And so what he's doing is getting his allies installed as governors and as secretaries of state so that even if he loses an election in a place like Pennsylvania or Arizona, his allies, the governors and the secretary of states, the individuals who decide which electors get sent to Washington, will choose his electors. Here's what's going to happen. The Democrats going to win a state like Arizona. The governor and the secretary of state, who are Trump allies of that state, will say, nope, we believe that there is some fraud. We won't pinpoint exactly what it is, but we think it's enough to instead send Donald Trump's electors to Washington, D.C. That's the exact plan that Trump is trying to put into place. And we've got to have a plan to guard against it. That's what the Electoral Count Reform Act is all about.
But does the Electoral Count Reform Act do anything to get that deep into how states run their elections? I mean, the federal government can't do that.
Well, all we can do is create a process to make sure that states follow their own laws. Remember, the Constitution actually says it's up to the states how they choose their electors. Every state has decided to award its electors to the winner of the popular vote, but it is true a state tomorrow could decide to award their electors to the candidate whose last name has the most number of letters. That is all up to the states. All we can do is create a process that holds the state to the law that they've written. And right now, every state says the winner of the popular vote gets our electors, we can create barriers to states trying to walk away from that commitment.
So what do you think the consequences might be if, you know, by November or by the end of this legislative session, the reform bill does not get through?
I mean, this is a really important reform, but it's a fairly narrow reform. And I think it's important for us right now to show that Democrats and Republicans can find common ground, agreement on cleaning up democracy to make sure that another January 6th doesn't happen. If we fail, it's a pretty awful message to the country, but it also just keeps our election laws open and vulnerable to attack in the next presidential election. And we just frankly know that attack is coming. President Trump has not been shy in making clear that he believes he won the 2020 election. And if he loses the 2024 election, he'll believe he won that too. So we need to be eyes wide open about the threat that's coming.
You said it in even stronger terms in your floor speech, right? You said the threat that 2024 will be the last year of American democracy. The last year of American democracy is real.
I think it is, and I don't want to suggest that the Electoral Count Reform Act is what saves American democracy. What this bill does is it sets up some additional barriers to a candidate trying to steal an election, but it cannot prevent a candidate from doing that. If a state legislature or a handful of state legislatures, the federal courts, and a presidential candidate and the Congress are aligned, then there's no law that can, you know, stop an election from being awarded to the losing candidate. So this bill makes that harder. But I also want to make it clear, it is up to human beings in the political system to decide to comply with the law, to only support the winner of an election being seated in power that will be dispositive on whether we hold on to our democracy.
Well, Senator Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy. And an important correction here. Earlier, I said there are 7 GOP co-sponsors to the bill. There are actually 9 Republican co-sponsors, 7 Democrats. We'll dig into the details when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at the newly unveiled Senate proposal to make reforms to the Electoral Count Act of 1887. And we're asking, is it enough or a significant amount of change to prevent another January 6th? Well, I'm joined now from Los Angeles by Matthew Seligman. He's a fellow at the Center for Private Law at Yale Law School, and he's previously taught many classes on disputed presidential elections. Matthew Seligman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us today from Iowa City, Iowa, is Derek Muller. He's a professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law, and he's also a nationally recognized scholar in the field of election law. Professor Muller, welcome to you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I first wanted to start by actually taking people back a little bit to 2020 again and ask, and I'll start with you, Matthew Seligman. You'll recall that President Trump and his allies assembled a group of legal scholars to look for weaknesses in the Electoral Count Act. So can you explain to us or remind us that John Eastman specifically, who wrote that famous memo outlining how Vice President Pence might change the outcome of the election, what is the opening that Eastman saw in the Electoral Count Act for overturning the election on January 6th?
So Professor Eastman's theory of how Vice President Pence could alter the results of the election was based on the interaction between the 12th Amendment to the Constitution and the Electoral Count Act. So the 12th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified in 1804, and it's the version of the Electoral College that we have right now. And there's a critical sentence in the 12th Amendment And it says that the president of the Senate, who is usually the vice president, shall, in the presence of the House and Senate, open the certificates, and then the votes shall be counted. And you'll notice in the end of that sentence, it's in the passive voice. It doesn't tell us who does the counting of the votes. And Professor Eastman latched on to this this grammatical ambiguity and advanced the theory that that this sentence of the 12th Amendment meant that Vice President Pence had unilateral power to resolve disputes about electoral votes, to reject a state's electoral votes on the basis of some allegation of fraud, or to, as it was often said at the time, to, quote, send it back to the states for states to somehow redo their appointment of the electors. Now, that's just inconsistent with what the Electoral Count Act says. The Electoral Count Act sets up a process for how Congress counts the electoral votes from each state, and as part of that counting process, how to resolve disputes about electors. And Professor Eastman argued that, well, whatever the Electoral Count Act of 1887 says, that's just unconstitutional. So he had some other arguments as well about how within the Electoral Count Act, perhaps it could be manipulated. But Professor Eastman's argument was based on this truly wild constitutional theory that the 12th Amendment gave the vice president the unilateral power to decide the results of the presidential election.
Okay. So, Professor Mueller, let me turn to you then, because from what I understand, one of the first and perhaps most straightforward thing that the new Electoral Count Reform Act proposes to do is simply to clarify that the role of the vice president is purely ministerial. But I guess that clarification was needed based on what happened on January 6th, but isn't the Electoral Count Act actually fairly, as it exists from 1887, straightforward enough on that point?
You would hope so. I mean, that when you read the Electoral Count Act, there's no question that sometimes these questions do arise about what happens if the vice president receives multiple submissions from states, competing slates of electoral votes. At what point should they properly present them to Congress? At what point should the vice president not present them to Congress? Does the vice president have any role in saying there's a lack of a quorum present? Does the vice president have any role in determining whether or not an objection is in order or not? So there are potentially ambiguities even within the existing Electoral Count Act. I think you're certainly right to say the vice president doesn't have the unilateral authority to throw out electoral votes. That is truly beyond the pale. But there are other uncertainties about how that sort of dance or process works inside of Congress. And so as a number of clever mechanisms in this bill are designed to ensure that there's going to be one set of electoral votes submitted to Congress, clear rules about how to identify that true single set of electoral votes, and then that reduces any questions or potential discretion that otherwise the vice president might try to exercise in that forum. So it helpfully clarifies it. And again, given some of the ambiguity, I think any increase in clarity is helpful public guidance going forward.
Okay, so let's explore in more detail then what else specifically the Electoral Count Reform Act, or proposal, I should say, at this point in time of 2022, says it might accomplish. Another major point, that it would raise the objection threshold needed to trigger debate during the count, which right now it's just one senator and one member of the House. Matthew Seligman, what would the threshold be raised to under the reform proposal?
So the proposal that's been released so far raises that threshold to 20% of the Senate and 20% of the House. And so that would be significantly higher than the threshold that we see right now. And indeed, that threshold, that raised threshold, would not have been met on January 6th of 2021, because although there was more than 20% of the House of Representatives signed on to the objections to the electoral votes from Arizona and Pennsylvania, there were only 7 or 8 senators who did so. So the objections in 2021 would not have met that threshold. And that really makes a big difference. One of the tragic tragedies of January 6, 2021 is that we saw how political grandstanding around the electoral count can lead to really dangerous places and tragically to violent places. It's important to remember that under the Electoral Count Act, there was absolutely no possibility that those objections were ultimately going to succeed. And the reason is because the House of Representatives was controlled by Democrats. And indeed, there was a large majority of Democrats and Republicans in the Senate that were going to vote against those objections. So it was always clear from well before January 6th, and indeed on the morning of January 6th, that these objections were going to fail. But nonetheless, politicians made the decision to make those objections, and that was political grandstanding. And the people standing on the steps of the Capitol took that as a cue, and that led to violent, dangerous places. So changing the law so the objection threshold is higher, which will prevent this type of political grandstanding when there's really only a very small minority of members of Congress who support an objection, well, it can head off that political grandstanding, and it can avoid the misimpression among the public that there's a real live, genuine dispute about the counting of electoral votes when really there's not.
I see. Professor Mueller, though, I'm not seeing any language in the reform proposal that would clarify the reasons by which members of the Senate or House could make an objection. And I raise that because, you know, earlier we played that clip from Representative Mo Brooks that, you know, during the debate on the night of January 6th and the morning of January 7th, I mean, he and other Republican members of the House were just offering reasons that were simply untrue. Now, there are some people, notably a Harvard Law professor, Lawrence Lessig, who thinks that the reform proposal should have clarified reasons that could be offered for an objection. Do you think that should have been the case, Professor Mueller?
Well, I mean, I think it's always a question then of if you specify the reasons, who's going to be bound by them, or who's going to make a determination about who's going to be bound by them. If you say the vice president has to determine if objections are in order or out of order, you've empowered the vice president to make some determinations, which we don't want. So this act actually does specify two specific kinds of objections, saying that, well, maybe if you have the wrong certificate of election, if somehow the wrong piece of paper has come in, that is, they were not lawfully certified, or if these votes were not regularly given, which I've written extensively about to suggest that it relates to the acts of the electors themselves, if they were subject to bribery, for instance, or if they voted on the wrong day, rare outlier exceptions. So you have some specific guidance, but there's no question, you're right, Magna, to say it's incumbent on Congress to view this statute as a whole, to read provisions that say things like when the results come in from a state as modified by any judicial process or recount, to accept them as conclusive. And that if you're going to file an objection, it's going to be very hard to do, and you're going to have to sort of justify it with reasons. And let's not forget that when Senator Ted Cruz objected to Arizona's electoral votes in 2021, his purported reason was to say, well, let's send it back to the states for a 10-day investigation. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the objection. The objection was, don't count Arizona's electoral votes. So that's a challenge of trying to shoehorn your objections into the language of the Electoral Count Act. And I think raising the threshold makes that significantly more of a challenge.
Yeah. Well, just one quick note about that phrase, regularly given. The editors at National Review have written, even in support of the Electoral Count Reform Act, I should note that they wrote that, in quote, in light of the mischief already created by efforts to read the phrase regularly given, we would prefer to see a definition of the term made explicit. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, again, I think it's a challenge about anything that you might list out might result in some future questions about, well, did we include everything,
right,
or did we forget something this time, you know, or something that doesn't precisely fit. You know, it wasn't until 1873 that Congress had to figure out, what do we do if someone casts an electoral vote for someone who's dead? You know, there are these novel questions that arise. So anytime you put a list out there, there's that risk about what might happen in the future. And again, I think why that procedural barrier of 1/5 is so critical, even in the absence of more explicit guidance.
Okay. Now, so these are some of the more straightforward, I would say, aspects of the electoral count reform proposal. But Matthew Seligman, you think that there's another part that is really the heart of the reform, or the most crucial part of it. What is it?
Well, so there are two remaining parts, and I think we'll talk about both of them. So the first remaining part is there's in the current law, there's this exception for when states can appoint electors. So the Constitution says that states get to decide the manner of appointing electors, but Congress gets to set the time. And Congress has said states you have to appoint electors on Election Day, but there's an exception for when what the statute says right now, if a state, quote, fails to make a choice on the appointed day. And that is a really vague phrase that opens things up to mischief. So that's one remaining part, is fixing that. And then the final remaining part, which I think is the most important part of this proposed legislation, is to fix the process by which states transmit their electoral votes to Congress and the process by which Congress counts it. And the reason why this final piece of the puzzle is the most important, in my view, is because it directly addresses the threat of political manipulation of the electoral count. That's what we're concerned about. And if you were listening to Senator Murphy before, that's exactly what the members of the bipartisan group are trying to fix in this legislation. And so the existing law is, I've written, catastrophically vulnerable by political manipulation by governors and then by members of Congress. And in particular, the way the law is written right now says that if Congress receives multiple pieces of paper that purport to be a state's electoral votes, and then the chambers of Congress disagree about which of those pieces of paper really are the electoral votes for that state, then that tie is broken by the governor of the state. Mm. And what that means, if you unpack it, and if you think about it from the perspective of, okay, if I was trying to steal a presidential election, how would I do it? Then all it takes is for one rogue governor to say, I don't care about the results of the election in the state. I'm going to say there was massive fraud, even though I don't have evidence for it. And that governor, that rogue governor, sends in their own preferred bogus slate of electors. And then in Congress, one chamber, let's say the hyperpartisan House of Representatives, goes along with what that governor says and says, yes, we believe, you know, we don't care about what the Board of Elections in the state says. We don't care about the recounts. We think there was massive fraud, and goes along with the governor's conspiracy theory. Then that governor and that single chamber of Congress can conspire together, can collaborate to steal the state's electoral votes. Under existing law, it's really that easy. And that is a catastrophic vulnerability, because we've seen that politicians, governors, and members of Congress are increasingly willing to take those types of partisan steps. So one of the most important, and I think the most important changes that the Electoral Count Reform Act makes, is to attack that problem. And the way that it does it, the overarching principle is to say that courts, rather than politicians, should have the final decision-making authority to resolve disputes about who the validly appointed electors are. Now, the legal mechanics of how this particular statute tries to implement that principle are pretty complicated. And I know Derek will agree with me that, you know, once you get into the weeds of trying to build a system that implements that principle, that courts and not politicians decide, it gets really, really hard to do it in a way that's, you know, relatively straightforward and understandable, and also pretty immune from creative ways of trying to manipulate the electoral count. But that's what this legislation is trying to do. And I think it does it really well. You know, it's not perfect. And, you know, there are people out there who have made good faith criticisms of the way that it implements that principle. But I think that it has the right principle, and it's gone a long way towards implementing it in a way that can prevent the kind of political manipulation that we're scared of for 2024 and beyond.
Okay, so Professor Mueller, I want to give you a crack at this. We've just got about a minute to go before our next break here. But I am seeing some criticism, though, of the way that the Electoral Count Reform Act seeks to remedy the situation that Matthew Seligman described. I mean, there's this expedited judicial review that we're discussing here in the proposal. And also, if I understand correctly, that review may ultimately, that would go through a three-judge panel and then would have to end up potentially upon appeal in front of the Supreme Court, whether the court wants to hear it or not. You know what? In fact, because I am hearing that music, Professor Mueller, I'll give you a chance to respond to my question when we come back from a break. So we're talking about the newly released Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022 and whether or not it's enough to prevent another January 6th. So we'll be back in just a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at the bipartisan Senate proposal called the Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022. And we're asking if what's in this bill, in terms of changing and clarifying language around how the Electoral Count Act is, how the electoral count is supposed to happen, would be enough to prevent another January 6th. I'm joined by Matthew Seligman today and Derek Mueller as well, and Professor Mueller. So back to this question about this expedited judicial review that is proposed in this reform legislation. There are some concerns, even with Matthew Seligman's points well taken, there are concerns that this might end up putting too much power in the hands of the federal courts and potentially even put the Supreme Court in an awkward position of being forced to hear election or electoral slate disputes that they, you know, wisely sort of stayed out of in 2020. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think ever since Bush versus Gore, we've relied on the federal courts more and more to be adjudicating a lot of these election disputes. And we saw dozens of such cases filed in 2020. And the court system held up pretty well. But the question is now about this specific mechanism. So there are a few things that are happening. First, it doesn't displace any of the important role that the state courts, the federal courts have already been playing, whether there are disputes about recounts or election contests that states set up, there's still the opportunity to do those things in the weeks after an election in the event that there's a close election or problems that arise. But the act importantly says to states, you need to wrap this up 6 days before the electors meet. In the past, that was a strong suggestion. There would be a presumption that you'd met the safe harbor if you resolved everything. This is now a hard and fast deadline saying get your certificate of election out at that point in time. And if that deadline comes and the governor has failed to issue the certificate or has issued, as Matt pointed out, a rogue certificate, then there's the opportunity. You can still go to state court, but if you wanted to go to federal court, there's a quick expedited process to say you've got an existing constitutional violation, an equal protection violation, whatever it might be. You go into court in front of a three-judge panel that will promptly hear this case. All of the important litigation has already happened in the weeks leading up to certification. But if it's about that certification itself, you have the opportunity to get into a three-judge panel with expedited review to the Supreme Court. And frankly, it doesn't force the Supreme Court to hear the case because the court can always decline or not give reasons for refusing to hear it. But it gives at least the avenue there if there is a problem.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification, because I've been reading some other legal scholars who say that they believe that the Supreme Court would have to hear these cases. So apparently there's just differences of opinion on that. But if I could just go back to Matthew Seligman here for a second. So, you know, your example of a governor going rogue, though, that is exactly the thing that, as you well know, for example, Democratic elections lawyer Mark Elias says he's worried about regarding what the Electoral Count Reform Act proposes, right? Because, you know, he says that the requirement is that each governor must submit a certificate of ascertainment identifying the state's presidential electors, and that that document is conclusive with respect to the determination of electors appointed by that state. So the governor's document is conclusive. And Elias says conclusive is a really strong word. And under that interpretation, the declaration of a governor could not be challenged, even if there was strong evidence to the contrary. So Matthew, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the most important starting point for addressing Mark Elias's concerns, you know, he's a very experienced election lawyer. He's been in the trenches, so I think his perspective and his views worth taking seriously. Now, he and I share a goal for what this reform should do, which is to take politicians, and in particularly, he and I are most worried about state politicians, governors, trying to use their political power to manipulate the electoral count. So we want the same thing. And so the question here is whether this bill in its current form achieves what both Mark Elias and I want. And I think the answer is yes. The reason is because Mark Elias is absolutely right that the word conclusive is really strong. It's supposed to be the strongest legal term that you can have. The question, though, is conclusive on whom? And the answer to that question in the text of the statute as it's written right now, the proposed legislation, is that the governor's certificate is conclusive on Congress, not on courts. And so the way the system is supposed to work here is that the governor issues a certificate appointing the electors, and then that certificate can be challenged in court through the three-judge panel process that we just spoke about. And the governor's certificate is not conclusive on the court. The court will then look and say, okay, did you actually follow the state law? Did you follow federal law in appointing who the real validly appointed electors are? And then the statute says that the court can order that the governor revise that that certificate. So what that does is it means, okay, so the governor's certificate isn't binding on a court. A court can actually order the governor to revise it to make sure that the governor is sending in a certificate that names the real validly appointed electors. Then once we get to Congress on January 6th, then that judicially reviewed and endorsed governor's certificate is conclusive on Congress. Now, the reason why that conclusive language is so important is because it binds Congress. It says that Congress can't second guess what had already happened before. And what had already happened before is that the governor signs a certificate that is reviewed and endorsed by a court. So I think that the way the statute is structured right now already achieves what he wants, which is to prevent governors from being able to manipulate things by signing a bogus slate of electors. And it has this judicial review mechanism to ensure that that won't happen.
Got it. You know, I only have a couple minutes left with both of you here, and I have a question for you each. So first of all, Professor Mueller, what is the conservative argument in favor of supporting the Electoral College Reform Act?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you don't know what's going to happen in the future, right? And I think the goal is you want to provide clarity and stability. Well, I know there's a lot of focus on the election of 2020 and what Donald Trump did. There's no question that this act has shown its strain, and there have been Democratic objections in Congress in 2005 about the electoral votes in Ohio, and questions about the votes in 2001 and in 2017 in Congress. And the notion is, if we can come up with good, fair, neutral rules that can govern for the next century, that's something we should applaud and want to achieve. So I think while there's certainly a narrow focus about looking at 2020 and addressing 2024, I think everyone is on board with providing stability and improvement in these ambiguities for whoever might try to exploit them in the future.
Mm. But Matthew Seligman, it doesn't seem to me to be clear at all that this proposal, the Senate proposal, could make it through the House, right? Because I mean, we're already seeing, in fact, some vocal disagreement coming from Democratic members of the House. I'm seeing that Congressman Jamie Raskin is calling the Electoral Count Reform Act fine and necessary, but not remotely sufficient to meet the magnitude of the threat against democracy. And Representative Zoe Lofgren saying there are some elements of what we've worked through, meaning the House, that might be superior. Are you concerned that perhaps, you know, whatever bill might come out of the House would end up being unpalatable to the required 60 senators needed to get it through the Senate? And as Senator Murphy said earlier, that perfect would be the enemy of the good, and we may end up with nothing.
Well, I think that is a concern. You know, the House and the Senate for the entire history of our nation have been in a rocky marriage. And I hope that the well-meaning ideas of members of the House of Representatives who want so many important reforms, that won't get in the way of getting this. So critics will point out that there are so many important things that this bill doesn't do. It doesn't do anything at all to protect voting rights. It doesn't address campaign finance reform. It doesn't address political partisan gerrymandering, which is, you know, in my view, the other great threat to American democracy. And for that matter, it doesn't abolish the Electoral College and institute a national popular vote. And the critics are right. It does none of those things. But those things aren't on the table. There was a massive push. Every political effort was put into trying to enact comprehensive federal election reform legislation back in January. And there is simply insufficient political support in the Senate for that to happen right now. So in advance of this next election cycle, we face a choice. And the choice is whether we enact the Electoral Count Reform Act or something close to it, something, you know, there's still time to make modest revisions to improve it, whether we enact that or we enact nothing. And nothing is such a dangerous and catastrophically risky option that I hope and I ultimately trust that members of both parties of Congress will recognize that that's just something that is too risky to let leave on the table, these risks of catastrophic political manipulation.
Well, Matthew Seligman, fellow at the Center for Private Law at Yale Law School, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Derek Mueller, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Professor Mueller, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, let's pull this all together with the help of Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay. So given what you heard from both Matthew and Derek there, do you think you heard enough to convince you that the Electoral Count Reform Act would close the gaps Donald Trump and his allies tried to exploit on January 6th?
Yes, it sounds like it would close some of them. The trouble is there are new gaps opening, and these are, well, I take my text from Joseph Stalin. He said, "I consider it completely unimportant who in the party will vote or how. What is important is who will count the votes. And how." He was alluding there to, well, in our terms, the Secretary of States in the various states. And Trump denialists, election denialists, running often supported by Trump PAC for office, that office in the five key swing states. The Secretary of State from Michigan has said, it's like putting arsonists in charge of a fire department. That would be what it would be like having such people in office. In Arizona, There's an arsonist all set to go. He's been picked by the voters. He has a primary, but it looks like he will win. And on the Democratic side, there's a vulnerability. Katie Hobbs, the incumbent, is running for governor. So there's an open seat, and the advantage of incumbency is lost. And it's not a good sign that in a debate between the two Democratic candidates to succeed her, it drew an audience of only 70 people. Not a good sign. In Georgia, things look good. Brad Raffensperger, we know his integrity. It's been proved. The Democrat he's running against would also stoutly defend voting rights. The trouble is the GOP-led state legislature has written a law to abolish the Secretary of State's control over the elections in Georgia and to vest that in an election committee, essentially picked by the legislature. That could happen before 2024. In Michigan, the Republicans have nominated, I think the technical term is kook, Christina Camaro is her name. She's made much about calling yoga a satanic ritual. She's attended sort of QAnon adjacent rallies. She goes on a lot about sexual deviance. Luckily, if any sanity holds in Michigan, the incumbent, Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, would be elected. So Michigan looks good. Wisconsin, the Secretary of State there is not in charge of election. A commission is. But the Republicans in the legislature want to change that. They want the Secretary of State to have that control. So that's it at issue in the election. The Republican candidate favors that. The Democratic candidate says, no, we have to stick with the commission. He has been in office since 1974. People might feel it's time for a change there. And the most flagrant situation, of course, is in Pennsylvania, where the Doug Mastriano, the gubernatorial candidate, is an out-and-out election denier. Organized buses to go to the Capitol, was outside the Capitol during the insurrection. And he says, I get to appoint the Secretary of State, who has the power to make the corrections to elections, to look at the voting logs. And I could, with a stroke of a pen, decertify every election machine in Pennsylvania. That is a mortal threat to democracy if this man is elected in that crucial swing state.
Mm. Well, so Jack, the point you're making that while reform efforts for the Electoral Count Act are all well and good and necessary, Congress can't do anything if the slates of electors arriving to them come through a highly manipulated process at the state level, and that threat still exists as well.
It certainly does, and it's only grown stronger, and it's backed up by a precinct level. That's the sort of state level, Secretary of State, but there's a precinct level organization now on the Trump side that would a sort of network of people who would staff election offices, recruit poll workers and poll watchers. And interestingly, there was a separate election reform bill in Congress to protect election workers that could only get 5 Republican votes. So there's a new vulnerability right at the precinct level where Trump people are going to be challenging voters and even questioning postal workers about valid addresses and the like.
Mm. Well, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you as always, Jack.
Thank you.
All right, one last note for this Friday version of On Point. We have a special drop in our podcast feed. It's a conversation I recently had with Franklin Leonard. He's a Hollywood exec who's really challenging Hollywood's vision of it being a meritocratic system. And it was part of a conversation we had at KPCC in Pasadena, California. It's a really great conversation. You're going to learn a lot about how Hollywood works and doesn't work. So go to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts, and check it out. Thanks, everyone. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.